You're listening to the San Joaquin Sound, the podcast about music in Bakersfield and the surrounding San Joaquin Valley. I'm your host, AJ Rodriguez. Today I traveled to the Fairfax Grange to interview Zane Adamo, singer and fiddle player for the Soda Crackers. Can you tell me a little bit about your band?
The Soda Crackers started in October of 2021. Started off as like a jam session on Wednesday nights. From there, we booked our first show in Tehachapi, California. And then we played our like first official show as the Soda Crackers from that jam session in Taft later that year, October 2021. And then here we are today. We're a five-piece, sometimes six-piece band when my little brother's in town. Always tell people we're a Bakersfield sound band. We play Western swing music.
What are all the members of the Soda Crackers?
So we have six members of the Soda Crackers. So the Soda Cracker that's been there the longest since day one is our bass player, Chuy Holguin. He plays stand-up bass, and he's from Santa Ana, California. And then our drummer, Jeff Giroux, is from Bakersfield, but he lives down in San Dimas. But he's from Bakersfield, Jeff Giroux. He's on drums. And then we've got my little brother, Cooper Adamo. He lives out in Oklahoma City. Born, raised here, went to BHS. He plays fiddle. He's our lead fiddle player. And then we have a steel guitar player out of Camarillo, California. His name is Ben Matthews. And then our newest Soda Cracker is Ben McCarthy, and he's on lead guitar from Ramona, California. And then myself, lead singer, fiddle player, and I play rhythm guitar, and I'm born, raised here in Bakersfield as well.
You're inspired by a lot of country musicians from the past, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of people in the past and a lot of songs and artists that we play and cover that I don't think get their fair share of the credit. And so we try to play their music and remind people of, you know, people like Gene Shepherd, Wynn Stewart, Tommy Collins, all those greats.
I think we should talk a little bit about what Bakersfield was like in the past. I read the book, The Bakersfield Sound, How a Generation of Displaced Okies Revolutionized American Music. And that book was written by Robert Price. A lot of my understanding of what Bakersfield was like back then comes from that book.
Yeah.
Bakersfield was sometimes referred to as Nashville West. Mm. It was just so important to country music. It had a massive impact and changed what a lot of other artists were doing at the time. Buck Owens alone had 21 number one Billboard country hits. Two were even side A and side B of the same single. Merle Haggard had 38 number ones. In 1965, Buck Owens, Merle Haggard, Bonnie Owens, and Kay Adams swept the first Academy of Music Country Awards in LA. So Bakersfield was really at a peak at this point, right, in the 60s?
Yeah, and it's important to also note that Billy Mize was instrumental in that ACMAs?
Yeah.
Yeah, that award show, Billy Mize was part of the people who put that together. So he was another Bakersfield sound artist. I don't think a lot of people know who Billy Mize is, but he played a huge role in the country music that came out of Bakersfield.
And was he one of the people that was telling people to come to Bakersfield to get country musicians to Bakersfield?
I'm sure he was. He was around, a lot of these stories I've heard from people who might not be with us anymore or people who lived in those decades of country music.
Sure.
But Billy Mize was around in the early days, and he was a band leader. He played steel guitar. He was an amazing singer, and he wrote songs, beautiful songs. But the person that I've always been told who was kind of the glue and bringing people in and putting people together up on stage was Bill Woods. A lot of people consider Bill Woods the father of the Bakersfield sound.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So in the early 1950s, a lot of artists that people might have heard of were playing at different honky-tonks and dance halls here in Bakersfield. Roy Nichols was playing at the Pumpkin Center Bar Dance. Buck Owens was playing with Bill Woods at the Blackboard, mm-hmm. that was located at 3801 Chester. We had Billy Mize, who we talked about earlier, who was playing at the Lucky Spot, mm-hmm. located at 2303 Edison Highway. Louis Talley and Fuzzy Owen were playing at the Clover Club, also on Edison Highway. You had the Tex Barrel House on Golden State Highway. The Rainbow Gardens was a dance hall, and honky-tonks were more for adults, and there were all-ages dance halls where anyone could go dancing, right?
Yeah, I think the honky-tonk and dance hall kind of paradigm is very interesting because the honky-tonks are what a lot of people think of country music of is today. You know, traditional country music, honky-tonk, like old dimly lit bar room, smoke, lots of beer, lots of drinking, 21 and up, bar fights, that kind of stuff. But dance halls were something that a lot of the Okies, a lot of the Texans, a lot of the people from Arkansas, Missouri, they brought that kind of way of life out here too, because there's a lot of dance halls out in like hill country in Texas and Oklahoma that look just like Rainbow Gardens or even the Fairfax Grange where we're at today.
Yeah, I read that there were a lot of work camps even for the displaced people that came to work here from Oklahoma and from Texas and Arkansas and other places.
Yeah.
At night, they would have dances there in those
I think it's the Sunset Labor Camp right here just by Lamont.
Oh, yeah?
I can't remember if it's like Sunset or Sunrise, something like that. But I think it might be Sunset Labor Camp, and there's a dance hall that's still there. It's like a museum dedicated to, they call them Hoovervilles.
That's cool. So the Rainbow Gardens was another dance hall, and that was located at 2301 South Union, and that's where Buck Owens and Merle Haggard first saw Bob Wills and Lefty Frizzell play.
So the Rainbow Gardens is now the Bass Hall off of South Union, so it's still standing, and it's the last one of like the dance halls, the classic old school dance halls that's still around. I heard that Merle Haggard saw Bob Wills for the first time at the Beardsley Ballroom in Oildale off of Beardsley. And then he got to go up and play with Lefty. He opened for Lefty Frizzell at the Rainbow Gardens. I think the story goes Merle's friend who he was there with told Lefty that he could sing just like him. And so Lefty gave him his guitar, gave Merle his guitar, and told him, like, well, let's hear what you got. And he started singing. And then Lefty told his manager, he's like, you better let that kid go up there and sing before I do, or I'm not playing. So.
Wow.
And then later on, Merle Haggard bought Lefty Frizzell's guitar, his like classic guitar, says Lefty on the pick guard. So very full circle moment.
Back then, there was also the Fairfax Grange, which we're sitting in today, which was more of the dance hall type, right?
Yeah, the Grange halls are more of like a community space, but you know, they built them for families to have dances, for concerts, for anything they need them to be. And we used to have 9 here in the Kern County area, and the Fairfax Grange is the last one standing. So it opened in 1940 and it's still here.
Another thing in Bakersfield at the time, in the late 50s and early 60s, there was only 3 TV stations. There was KERO Channel 10, and they had Cousin Herb's Trading Post every night before the news. And KAFY Channel 17 had Jimmy Thomason show. I think KBAK 29 had its own show as well.
Yeah, Cousin Herb and then Jimmy Thomason. Jimmy Thomason had the like iconic blue electric fiddle. He was like a band leader. My dad talks about like watching the Jimmy Thomason show as a young kid out here in Bakersfield, and also the Cousin Herb show too.
Wow.
Yeah.
A blue fiddle. I mean, you see a lot of different color fiddles now, but back then I would think that might be one of the few.
Yeah. I mean, when you're a showman, when you're a frontman, you gotta get up on stage and you gotta give people a show. So having a blue fiddle is something people would pay a ticket to come see. And that blue fiddle is at the Kern County Museum. It's in the Bakersfield Sound exhibit.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. There, yeah. Yeah, back then, if you've never seen what country musicians look like from classic Bakersfield Sound, it was very more dressed up. A lot of rhinestones and really colorful suits.
Yeah.
The Maddox and Rose had amazing costumes, and Buck Owens himself, you know, he had a multicolored American flag colored guitar and a bunch of different color suits that he wore with rhinestones.
Maddox Brothers and Rose, I think they're like, slogan was the world's most colorful hillbilly band, or America's most colorful hillbilly band. And then Buck Owens, you know, he just turned it to 11. Like everything was sparkle, everything was sequence, everything was embroidered. And he kind of had that, and a lot of people say it looks like kind of like a charro suit, kind of like a mariachi suit. And definitely. So he had these like short jackets that were hemmed at the waist, and but he had all these embroiderments and rhinestones, and they just like looked like a million bucks, and they knew that they had to put on a show from start to finish. And so like with the Soda Crackers, we always make sure we dress the part and give people that kind of experience you would have had in the 40s, 50s, or 60s.
Also back in this time, the 99 wasn't where it is now. It was Union Avenue.
Yeah,
it was 99. And if you've ever seen the Bakersfield sign that's outside the Crystal Palace, which does have in it a bunch of these outfits and costumes almost of this time, but outside there's the iconic Bakersfield sign. You've probably driven under it or seen pictures of it. Well, that sign, the only thing that existed are the letters.
Yeah.
And those letters are from a bridge that went over Union Avenue back then.
It went to the Bakersfield Inn, and it was like just south of California in Union. And my dad has photos of them taking down that bridge and preserving the letters. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, yeah. People define the Bakersfield sound in a lot of different ways. How do you define it?
I feel like I ask myself this question a lot, and I keep, you know, adding to my answer or taking things away from it. But for me, there's only really one era of the Bakersfield sound. There was never a second, you know, generation or third generation of the Bakersfield sound. There's one generation that really kind of built this sound, this identity. And for me, it comes from the people that came from the Dust Bowl, the migrant families that came from Texas, Oklahoma, yeah. Arkansas, Kansas, all these plain states and western states, where these people lost everything and they moved out to the West Coast out here and didn't have much better of a life. And through that struggle, you had artists, you know, create amazing music and create amazing songs. And the Bakersfield sound to me started in the late 40s and it had its heyday in the 60s and kind of died off in the mid 70s, more or less. It's that kind of right on the edge country music sound where like rockabilly and country music, there's that gray area where you don't really know what you're listening to, but you kind of like it. And it's all about getting people up and dancing and have a good time. That's what the Bakersfield sound is to me.
Yeah. For me, the Bakersfield sound also exists as almost a protest to what was going on in Nashville.
Yeah.
It's a stark contrast. What's interesting is that in Nashville around this time, there was a lot of production. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of background singers, string sections. They were going for almost an elegant sound.
Yeah.
And you have Buck Owens and other people in the Bakersfield sound making something that's like a lot more raw. The production is more raw. It feels almost live.
Yeah.
Another reason that could be because in Nashville, they all use the same band and just rotated out the singers.
Yeah.
But here, a lot of times they would record it at the Capitol building. Mm-hmm. Right in LA, but they were allowed to bring their band. So Buck Owens had his Buckaroos to record. Merle Haggard took his Strangers to record. Mm-hmm. And so there's some authenticity to having your own band that you play with on the road and at these honky tonks and dance halls around there to be actually recording it with them. And you can just hear it.
That is true. Like, I think in many ways, if you want to get into the business side of things, if you want to go all the way back. So for me, the like foundation of the Bakersfield sound really started with Western Swing and Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys, because Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys proved to everybody that you didn't need Nashville. You didn't need to record at RCA in Nashville. You didn't need to record out in New York. You could be your own massive success out in Texas and Oklahoma. And the heydays of Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys was the 30s, 40s, and you know early 50s. He started tailing off his career. But that's right around the time where Buck Owens, Merle Haggard, Billy Mize, Red Simpson, all those guys were young men. And then the women of the Bakersfield sound, too. Young women were all listening to Bob Wills and being like, well, he's not out in Nashville. He doesn't need Nashville. Why should we need him?
There's like sometimes almost a punk attitude to it.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. It's very anti-establishment, very like, no, like we're going to do it our way and then you guys are going to like it. And they did. So,
yeah.
Out here, you know, Capitol still had their sessions musicians. Like Buck Owens was a sessions guitar player before he was his own star. Glenn Campbell was a sessions musician before he became his own star. James Burton, Ricky Nelson's guitar player, played on a lot of early Merle Haggard. And Wynn Stewart, Tommy Collins, they all had bands, but sometimes they would have musicians from Capitol Records. But I think if you want to like really get down to the nitty gritty details, and I think you could relate to this, out here on the West Coast, we're almost all descendants of people that just thought there's got to be something better. You know, I'm not going to stay in Ohio, nothing against Ohio or Kansas. Like, no, I'm going to keep going west. It's got to get better. I'm keep going to California. That's where you can make it out there. And you still see people try to make their dreams happen out in here in California. And I think that's where some of that attitude of the Bakersfield sound comes from.
So when we talk about Bakersfield sound, another thing that comes to mind is the Fender Telecaster electric guitar.
Mm-hmm.
How does that factor in to the sound?
Man, Fender came from Orange County, started in Fullerton. I actually, we play the Soda Crackers. We play a place Caddy Corner to where Fender got started at it was a radio repair shop. That's how he got his business started and started building amplifiers, and everybody loved his amplifiers. He's like, well, shoot, I'm gonna make guitars now. Before the Telecaster, everybody was playing these big arch top hollow body semi acoustic electric guitars. like Gibsons, Gretsches, and they sounded great, and but they weren't as powerful as like a solid body guitar with yeah. these pickups. And you know, you would need to crank your guitars, you know, your Gibsons and your Epiphones up quite a bit just to cut through these crowds of hundreds of people at these dance halls. And when you had a Telecaster, you could just crank it up and just be one guitar player and just pierce right through everything. And in many ways, the guitar players from the Bakersfield Sound era really catapulted the brand that is Fender into, you know, the giant company that it is now today. Like Don Rich and Roy Nichols, some yeah. of the best guitar players in the world, and especially in country music, play Telecasters.
Yeah, and to add to that about being able to crank the Telecaster really loud, it was really loud at the honky-tonks, right?
Oh, yeah.
They were cranking it.
Yeah.
I heard someone talk about how it was the loudest they've ever heard.
Yeah.
They would just be in this these small honky-tonks with all the amps cranked up.
A lot of those semi-acoustic guitars, if you crank them too much on the amp and also on the guitar, you get a lot of natural feedback. And
yeah.
so with a solid body, there is no chance for feedback because there is no like chamber for that to happen. And so you could just 10 and 10 and just boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
So we mentioned Western swing.
Yeah.
We talked a little bit about swing in our jazz episode that talked about Mary Osborne. How does Western swing connect to jazz at all?
You know, it's the improvisation of the musicians, like on the spot. That's where a lot of Western swing borrows from jazz. And Western swing borrows a lot from the blues from the black community, borrows a lot from the Czech and German polkas from Europe, and you find out in Texas. Borrows a lot from everything, and it kind of just mashes it all together, and it becomes Western swing. And so it has that big band feel, but it's got people playing these polka beats, these two-step songs, these waltzes. They're pretty much being jazz musicians, just playing on the spot, playing and reacting to musicians around them.
Yeah. I also read that some people like Willie Cantu had a jazz background.
Yeah.
Different musicians.
I've met Willie. He's still around. He's in good health, and he lives out in the Nashville area. And he always wanted to be a jazz musician. But when I was talking to Willie out in Tennessee, he told me that, so I think it was Don and Doyle, Don Rich and Doyle Hawley, went to go see him playing with the band that he had played in Texas. I think he's from like the South Texas area.
Oh, yeah.
And he got the job as the Buckaroo drummer because he could play super fast. He was very good technically as a drummer.
Yeah.
And so jazz drummers obviously have to be technically masters, you know, and be able to play as fast or as slow as they need to or as complex as they need to. And so he got the job for being, you know, the drummer that he wanted to be.
I heard that some of the parts that he made, he was just making up on the day of
yeah.
them recording. Heard it, and he's like, okay, I got something for that.
He said something. Willie is such that he's the nicest guy. You would think that, you know, I was afraid to talk to him because he's the original. In my opinion, he's like the Buck Owens drummer. Even though he wasn't there for very long, he was
yeah.
there, I want to say, like 64 to 67, something like that. And arguably that was Buck's golden years, you know, of his career. And Buck Owens told him, I think he told Willie, he's like, I'll always tell you when you're doing something I don't like, and we always play on top of the beat. And then Willie said, okay, sounds good. And then Willie told me, he's like, I had no idea what Buck meant by play on top of the beat. And so he just did what he thought he could do, and
yeah.
the rest is history.
What about your cousin Ronnie Sessions?
Yeah.
He was part of the Bakersfield Sound, right?
Yeah, Ronnie Sessions, little Ronnie Sessions. He was a little bit more on the younger side. Like, Buck was established, Merle was established.
Yeah.
He's a couple years older than my dad, so he was born, I think, in the early 50s, maybe late 40s. I don't know how old he was. He just recently passed a couple months ago.
Oh, my condolences.
Thank you. But he was around and played and recorded for Mosrite Records here in town. I think he was managed by Simi Mosley. And then his biggest song, Wiggle Wiggle, I think went number 16 on the country music charts. And he was signed to MGM and RCA Records. And he had a modest career out in Nashville. And he lived out there. And yeah, he recently passed a couple months ago. Never got to meet him, though.
Oh, man.
My little brother got to meet him, though. So he moved out to Nashville, I think, when he was a young man. And so he lived most of his life out on the East Coast. But my little brother, Cooper, got to meet him right before he passed. I think maybe about 6 or 7 months before he passed. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's amazing that he did country music and you are too.
Yeah. Yeah. He's my cousin once removed. So he's my dad's first cousin. So my first cousin once removed, yeah.
Yeah. Ronnie Sessions was signed to Mo's Right Records,
mm-hmm.
and that was owned by the same company as Mo's Right Guitars, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So a lot of the people from this era were playing Mo's Right Guitars, right? We talked about Mo's Right Guitars in the Mary Osborne episode because her husband Ralph Scafidi worked there. How important were Mo's Right Guitars to the Bakersfield sound?
When you play a Mo's Right, you know exactly what you're playing. You could close your eyes and they give you a Mo's Right, and then just the feel of Mo's Rights too as well. I think the first ever Buck Owens acoustic guitar with the red, white, and blue, that's a Mo's Right guitar.
Wow.
And so the first ever like red, white, and blue acoustic guitar that Buck Owens plays was a Mo's Right. I'm not an expert at Mo's Rights, and I don't know the history as well as I should. People who played Mo's Rights, so like my cousin Ronnie Sessions played Mo's Rights. Gene Moles was legendary guitar player here in the Bakersfield Sound area and the Bakersfield area in general. He played on a lot of Red Simpson songs. He played on a ton of people's records, and he like developed the iconic Ventures model Mo's Right guitar.
Yeah.
And so he like did a lot of R&D and testing with Simi Mosley on that guitar brand or guitar model, the Ventures model. And then people like Joe Mafis played the double neck Mo's Right guitars. Larry Collins played a double neck guitar made by Mo's Right, and it all happened here in Bakersfield. And it's funny because there's obviously that strong connection with Mo's Right and the Bakersfield sound, but one of the most iconic surf bands in the world, the Ventures, played Mo's Right guitars.
Yep. There's a huge list of people that played Mo's Right guitars.
The Mo's Right guitar transcends Bakersfield sound. It's like,
yeah,
its foundation is in the Bakersfield sound, but it was used and played by so many people. I think Kurt Cobain played a Mo's Right.
Yeah, he did.
Yep. Too as well. There's a lot of people. Like I said, I'm not an expert at Mo's Right, but our pal Deke Dickerson, who recorded our album down in Northridge, he's coming out with like the definitive Mo's Right book in a couple of years. He's still doing like research and taking pictures of every Mo's Right that's ever been built. But I'm really excited to learn about Mo's Rights once he comes out with that book.
Are there any unsung heroes of the Bakersfield sound era that you'd like people to know about?
I think everybody should know about Wynn Stewart and Tommy Collins for sure.
Okay.
Especially Wynn Stewart. I think if you like Buck Owens, if you like close your eyes and think of a Buck Owens song, Wynn Stewart was sounding like that and writing, performing songs, and his band was sounding just like Buck Owens did 15 years before Buck was doing it. And he really laid that foundation for, like, when you think of Buck Owens, twang, and those songs and the songwriting, all that kind of stuff. Wynn Stewart and his steel guitar player, Ralph Mooney, who's another steel guitar legend. And then Tommy Collins, too, out of Oklahoma City, was another really big influence on Buck Owens and Merle Haggard. And I think those two people, those two gentlemen, don't get the credit that they deserve. I could go on and on. Like, Red Simpson, I feel like, doesn't get a lot of credit, and he deserved a lot of credit because he wrote amazing, beautiful songs. Bonnie Owens was an amazing, gifted songwriter and singer. Gene Shepherd, Ferlin Husky, I'm trying to think of any more. There's so many of them. It's hard to kind of pin down, but you know, I will say my personal favorite is Buck Owens. I just love mid-60s Buck. That's my favorite era of country music, and he was like the man. Like, no one could touch him in the mid-60s, and just his band, his style, his songwriting, everything, just 100%.
He was huge outside of country music. People like the Beatles are covering his songs.
He had an instrumental go number one. Like, who has a song that doesn't have words beat, you know, all the other songs?
That's
that have
wild.
Like, I don't think there will never be another instrumental number one hit. Unless, I could be wrong, but I don't see it happening. Buck did it. You know, and, you know, he was also an unbelievable businessman. He created an empire while he was around. He, you know, created that iconic red, white, and blue guitar. He didn't create it, but he, like, branded himself with that guitar. He had his own super successful TV show, Hee Haw, in the 70s and 80s. And then he also had the Buck Owens Ranch show that he recorded before Hee Haw. And he had, you know, two or three successful radio stations out here on the West Coast that are still around today.
Yeah.
And then he has the Crystal Palace too. But in terms of like overall musician, I think Merle Haggard's the best that ever was. He wrote the most amazing songs. He had the looks, he had the voice, and then he was an amazing, amazing musician too. And I don't think anybody comes close to the songs that he wrote, like the Mama's Hungry Eyes, Silver Wings, Today I Started Loving You Again, Swinging Doors, Ball Let Me, like, these are all just absolute staples in country music nowadays. And everybody owes so much to Merle Haggard, and he had such a prolific career. And it really depends on which day you ask me. I think it's either Buck or Merle is my favorite. But today it's Buck.
Yeah, there's definitely a reason why people think of them when they think of Bakersfield.
It's like Pepsi, Coke, you know. I think it's just, it depends on who you are.
Yeah. So the massive legacy of the Bakersfield sound era has really inspired you to make your own music, mm-hmm. right? How did you get started playing music?
I started playing fiddle when I was 6 years old. My mom and dad just absolutely love country music, love Western swing. They were dancing country out here way before I was around. I just want a big thank you to mom and dad for instilling country music love in me from day one. So they're the real heroes. They wanted me to like be a fiddle player. They like, when we have our son, we're gonna get him lessons when he was 6 years old. So I was actually taught classical violin, and my dad taught me fiddle music growing up. And then I've just always learned country music by ear. So I've never like read sheet music for country music. I played in symphonies and orchestras in high school. I played country music at senior centers all throughout town and growing up. And when I was in high school and junior college, I played in orchestras and symphonies too as well, but never was a part of a band, never a part of a country band, just played fiddle with some people at senior centers, never part of a band. And then went to college, never really found anybody that really liked the country music I did. The closest yeah. thing I found was somebody who wanted to be like a Johnny Cash tribute band. Like, I like Johnny Cash, but not enough to play him for 3 hours in a row.
I see, yeah.
And then I went down to LA and started meeting people when I moved out to the east side of LA that really liked the country music that I liked. And they opened my eyes to a lot of like rockabilly and country artists that I had never heard before. And then we started the Soda Crackers, and now we're here. I've been playing guitar since I was probably about 13, and then I play a little mandolin too as well. But I didn't start singing until I started the Soda Crackers. Our lead singer of the Soda Crackers, the original lead singer, he moved back home, and I was like the only dude that maybe sang one or two songs. And I was like, well, oh, yeah. I've wanted to be a part of a country band for so long, I guess I have to learn how to start singing.
So you stepped up to the plate for that.
There was a lot of rough shows and a lot of out of tune notes and a lot of videos of me in the band in the early days that where I look like an idiot, but
well, it's one way to learn. Just yeah. go and do it.
Yeah. And then we started, you know, we wrote our first originals in January of 2024, and we recorded here at the Fairfax Grange. So we have Two Step Solution and Grapevine Rag. They're out on Spotify and streaming, and it's available on vinyl record. And then we just finished up recording our first ever full album last Sunday too as well.
Wow.
And that will have five originals on it. Five originals, five covers.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a picture of you on Instagram with a guitar that you had when you were little, and it made me think of my first guitar.
Uh-huh.
I really wanted to play electric guitar.
Yeah.
And I begged my parents, please, please just buy me electric guitar. I want to play guitar. My parents were pretty strict and very religious, and they didn't really want me to play an electric guitar. My dad, he gave me $10, and he said, if you can turn this into enough money to get an electric guitar, then I'll drive you down to Guitar Center and we'll get one. And he thought, well, that's going to be it. He's going to spend it. But no, I went and I bought candy, and I sold candy at school for months until I had enough money to go to Guitar Center, and I had like $400 in like dollar bills. And I was like, Dad, take me to Guitar Center. I'm ready to buy the guitar. And we ordered a Squire Stratocaster.
Nice.
I still have that guitar. It's priceless. If I had to sell all my guitars but one, I would keep that one.
That's a great story.
And I wondered if you had a similar story about yours.
I kind of did. Yeah, so that first electric guitar that I bought, I know I probably, well, one, I bet my parents helped me out a little bit, but most of the money that I used to buy that guitar was my own money from like chores or like helping the neighbor rake leaves or something like that, you know, just doing little kid stuff. It was a Fender Stratocaster. It was black, and it was made in Mexico, and I was very proud that I got a Fender guitar.
Nice.
And I ended up selling that guitar, that Stratocaster, And, you know, part of me is like, maybe you should have kept your first electric guitar. But at the same time, I consider myself a fiddle player first, and I think I always will be. And so, like, my fiddle I have right now is, like, priceless. Like, there's no way I'm getting rid of that. Even if a nicer, newer, older, better-sounding fiddle came my way, that's the fiddle I have right now is the one I'm going to be playing forever. So
nice. I noticed you really strive to make authentic country music with the Soda Crackers. So what is authentic country music for you?
I think, you know, what makes it authentic and what we strive to do with the Soda Crackers. So even before the Soda Crackers were around, we were just like a jam session with friends. People would buy beers and pizza, and we would play at our buddy Josh's house for 4 hours and just have a good time. And we would just play songs that we all love, and they were all covers. The core of the Soda Crackers will always be, let's play the songs that we all love the way that we hear them, you know, like on the recording. So not like note for note recordings, because we still want, you know, to be artists and musicians and play them a little bit the way we see it.
Yeah.
But we're not going to put our own spin on, you know, a classic Buck Owens song. We're going to play it the way that Buck Owens would approve of. And we're going to play it in our style still as the Soda Crackers, but authentic to the recording that everybody knows.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
A lot of your music, maybe all of it, is meant for dancing, right?
Yeah.
And you've played at dance halls and had to fill a lot of time.
Yeah. You know, the longest show we've ever played is 4 hours. We have some people.
Wow.
Yeah. We played 4 hour shows. Granted, you take breaks, right?
But still, most bands don't do 4 hours.
So if you think about it, let's say it takes you comfortably 2 hours to set up, right? That's quite a lot of time to set up, but you know, you're not rushed at 2 hours. So there's 6 hours right there. You have the 4 hours of the show, 2 hours set up, and then you have probably takes you another hour and some change to tear down, put all your stuff back in the truck. So that's close to an 8 hour day, and you're probably talking to people for 8 hours straight. And some of these, you know, musicians, even like the working musicians that I've met since starting the Soda Crackers, like Tommy Hayes, Larry Petrie, Sunny England, they talk about playing these places like the Blackboard or Trout's or the Lucky Spot, where there was no such thing as AC, people smoke inside, and it was louder than hell. And it was like these guys were playing 4 straight hours, sometimes not taking breaks, in these places that had no AC, a bunch of cigarette smoke everywhere. And then they all had day jobs during the day and were raising families. And they did these shows like 6-7 nights a week out here in Bakersfield. You could go to like 7, 8, 9 different places in Bakersfield any night of the week, and there'd be country music dancing.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. And so sometimes when I think, you know, oh, we have a 4 hour show in a nice AC room or like outside on a patio, I think to myself, like, well, I don't have a family. I don't have a full time job like a firefighter or milkman, and we're taking breaks and no one's smoking cigarettes in our face, you know, so it's not all bad.
Yeah.
It's also a lot of fun too. It's fun playing this music with your friends. So even though 4 hours is a long time to play, you know, you're still having a great time. And then honestly, it's harder to play a 45 minute show than it is to play a 4 hour show, because you really got to make sure that 45 minutes really has an impact. And you can't warm up like you can in 4 hours. You got to hit it right from the start and finish strong.
You mentioned Trout's. We didn't talk about that, but that was another place. But don't you have a guitar made out of the Trout sign?
Yeah. Well, not the Trout sign. So it was the last of like the traditional honky tonks that was left around. And I can't remember what year it burned down and closed. It closed and then it kind of sat for a little bit and then it burned down. But I remember I was in college. So this must have been like maybe 2014, something like that. So maybe, is that 11 years ago?
Yeah, wow. That's 11 years ago.
11 years ago, I had just turned 21, more or less. And, you know, if anybody's from Bakersfield remembers Trout's on North Chester, it had no windows. It was just like this door into this place you couldn't see inside. You know, I love Oildale, but it's kind of like a little bit of a rougher part of town. And so you're thinking to yourself, I'm like, there's no way I have the confidence as like a 22-year-old guy to go in there by myself and see what's in there.
Oh, you mean after it was condemned and stuff?
No, not after. It was still a honky tonk. It was still going and stuff. And so I was like, well, you know, I'm not the biggest guy around. I can't, I can't really hold my own in case it wasn't worth the risk for me. And so I asked my dad, I was like, hey, Dad, I've never been to a honky tonk, but and I have this bad feeling that something's going to happen to Trout sooner or later. Can you take me to Trout's? And so one time when I came back for like the holidays, I asked my dad, like, can we go have a beer at Trout's? And so he took me to Trout's. So I went to Trout's once, and then it shut down, and then it was going to get turned into offices, and then it burned down. and it burned down right around my birthday. And so I went to Trout's and found a piece of wood from the burn site, because they still had like just the debris that was there.
Wow.
And I got that piece of wood, and I had my friend Bob Thompson down in Orange County make me a Telecaster with the Trout's wood, and I take it on the shows and take it on the road, and it's an amazing sounding guitar. I love it.
That's so cool.
Yeah. But I did forget to mention that Trout's wasn't as scary as I thought it was going to be, because I was like pretty terrified of Trout's. Not terrified, maybe that's the wrong word, but definitely like wasn't like looking to go in there at any given time. So that's why I asked my dad to go with me, just in case. But when I got in there, I was like, oh, this isn't that bad. It just looks a little bad from the outside. Not that it was bad to begin with, but Trout's wasn't as scary. But I do miss it. I really wish we had Trout's around.
Yeah. So you've been going on tour and on the road playing Bakersfield sound music all over. How has that gone?
It's been going really well. I love the travel involved in being a part of the band. Like, there's days where it's not as fun, right? Like when you're sitting in traffic or you've got to drive down to San Diego from Bakersfield. Like, it's a long day, but it's fun because people all up and down the state love the music that came from Bakersfield back in the Bakersfield sound era. And so when you're showing up to a show, you have a steel guitar, you've got fiddle, you got a stand-up bass, you got an electric guitar, you got drums, you got the whole package. Your band and yourself are dressed up head to toe, and then you're playing the music, you know, these legends and these people recorded their songs. People just, you just transport them back to like the music that they heard their parents or grandparents playing, and they just love it and they have a great time. We've played as far north as Sacramento. We've played as far south as San Diego. And we play often in the Orange County, LA area, very often out in the Central Coast. And we play in Kern County all the time. And then later this year, we're going out to Oklahoma and Texas. We're going on tour, first time for the band to be out of the state of California. We're going to be out there for 9 days, and we're playing 8 shows. So we're going to let everybody know out in Texas and Oklahoma that Bakersfield Sound is still being played out in Bakersfield.
That's awesome. How do you like being able to tell people you're from Bakersfield when you're on the road, especially since, you know, that calls back the type of music that you play?
You know, I was born and raised here. I went to Bakersfield High School, went to BC for a couple of years, and I live here now. It's a point of pride for me, and then I also feel like I have a bit of a responsibility as a Bakersfieldian to show people what the Bakersfield sound is, and so I don't take that lightly. But we also have a great time and have a fun time too as well, and we still want to be authentic to the music and us as artists too as well. But people love it.
So you said you just finished recording your album earlier. How's that gone?
It's gone really well. You know, it's taken a long time. So we started, the first session was in December of 2024. And so it's been about 8 months, 7 or 8 months since we first started recording for our album. And then we booked a second day and finished up the last bit of recording. And now we're in the mixing, mastering process of the album. Yeah. And then I'm getting the cover design and the label design all made. And we're going to come out with a 12-inch vinyl record.
Awesome.
And I'm hoping that's going to happen by maybe late November, early December. We'll have that all streaming everywhere and vinyl's ready to go.
So that's your first full-length release, so it's got to be exciting for you.
It is really exciting. It's all like Bakersfield sound from start to finish, the way we recorded our originals, our new originals that people haven't heard. I think they're like, when I've wrote the songs that I wrote, I think to myself, like, could I see Buck Owens singing this song? Could I see Wynn Stewart singing this song in the 60s? And so when I kind of put myself in that mindset, you know, that's when I start writing originals. And then we also did some covers, too, of legendary songs and musicians that I think we want on our album, just to show people where our influences come from, since it's our first debut album, LP.
For the songwriting for that album, who writes all the songs?
Well, you know, we rehearse, we have scheduled rehearsals, and then people who are ready to pitch songs to the band will get them ready to go. They'll practice them, they'll write all the songs down, and then we'll play them for the band and see if we like it or if we can kind of figure it out. If we don't, it's fine. If we do, then we'll just kind of keep messing with it. So for this album that we're coming out with now, our lead guitar player wrote 2 songs. He wrote a instrumental, and then he wrote a song, a vocal song. And then I wrote 2 new originals. And then I wrote a song, 2 Step Solution, that was on our debut single. We re-recorded that for like an album version. And then also we have a song that the guy who's essentially started the Soda Crackers, our buddy Josh Sorheim, he wrote a song called Texas Bell, and we recorded that one. Essentially, if Josh's house wasn't around, then the Soda Crackers would never have been a thing. So that's how the Soda Crackers started, at Josh's house. So we have Josh's song, we have two new originals for me, and then we re-recorded Two Step Solution, and then our guitar player Ben McCarthy wrote an instrumental, and he wrote another song. So we got six originals from the Soda Crackers, five from current members of the band, and then we have four covers.
That's awesome. I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Yeah, thank you. We're excited. It's been a long time coming, but you know, we didn't want to rush it, and we wanted to make sure that when it was time, it felt right and it feels right. So we're coming out with it. So
that's good. When someone listens to your record or they come to see you play live, what do you want them to come away with?
If someone came to our show or if someone listened to our record, I would hope that if they jumped in a time machine and went back to the blackboard in 1954 and went inside, they'd be like, that looks just like and sounds just like the Soda Crackers. I want people to think and feel like they're going back in time when they see us and see us play. And that's the experience I want everybody to take away, is like, if you feel like you just went into a time machine and you're hearing the songs the way you would have heard them at the blackboard. You would have seen the musicians act and dress and sound the way that you would have seen them back in the 50s, 60s, 40s, whatever era, from like that classic era of Bakersfield sound. And then I hope everybody has a good time and dance to this music that came from our hometown.
I noticed that you held a show called The Pioneers of the Bakersfield Sound.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
So we did three Pioneers of the Bakersfield Sound shows. The first one we did was at the Bakersfield Music Hall of Fame off of Q Street down there. And that was on July 30th. So it just happened, the anniversary of it just happened a couple of days ago, in 2022, so 3 years ago. It kind of came about because when we started the Soda Crackers, you know, as just any band does, nobody knows who you are, you know, and so you don't really have any fans, you don't really have anybody really knowing who you are to come see you.
Yeah.
But we've been playing traditional country music, we've been playing traditional Western swing, we've been playing dancing country music since day one, and just so naturally we just started meeting people who play this music as well or grew up with it. And a lot of these people from this like golden era of the Bakersfield sound from the 40s, 50s, and 60s, we started meeting those people that grew up with this music, or when they were in their 20s they were dancing at the blackboard to these songs. And we met Tommy Hayes, Sonny Anglin, and Larry Petrie actually filled in for us on our first ever Bakersfield show at Timbler Brewing back in 2021. The Pioneers of the Bakersfield Sound show was kind of this idea where I was like, well, you know, I want to put on something where the Soda Crackers band and are the people, the pioneers of the Bakersfield Sound, the people that, you know, they didn't have the recording careers like Merle Haggard or Buck Owens, you know, where those legends are up in, you know, the heavens of the Bakersfield Sound. These people like Tommy, Larry, Sonny, all these people, Jimmy Phillips, Norm Hamlet, they were all instrumental in their own ways and building what we now think of as the Bakersfield Sound. And so I wanted to put together a show where we kind of had our band, the Soda Crackers, kind of be the foundation and have these pioneers of the Bakersfield Sound kind of be the stars that they are in our community. And so we put on three of those shows, the first one being at the Bakersfield Music Hall of Fame. And then the second one was at the Kern County Museum in the Neon Plaza.
Oh yeah, that place is cool.
That was really cool.
I've never seen it at night, but even in the daytime, it's amazing
it's
to
awesome.
Walk around.
It was so cool putting on a show with all those neon signs around. And then the third one, the last one we did, so the second one was with Jimmy Phillips, Tommy Hayes, and Norm Hamlet, and then Sonny Anglin came up and sang a few songs with us. And then the last one was with Eugene Moles, who is the son of Gene Moles, Norm Hamlet, and Jimmy Phillips, and Sonny Anglin. And then Tommy Hayes was supposed to be there with us at the Fox Theater, but he passed away a couple months before. After the first Pioneer of the Bakersfield Sound show at the Bakersfield Music Hall of Fame, Larry Petrie passed away less than a month after that show. And so after Tommy passed away, it felt like, you know, we played a show at the Fox Theater with these legends, and it just felt like a good time to, you know, we did three, and I felt like a fourth one would have been stretching it, so we wanted to end on a high note.
Yeah.
And so we kind of called it a day on the Pioneer shows after the Fox Theater show.
Yeah, but that's so cool you're able to honor their legacy
yeah.
and still have them playing.
because we just wanted to like put this show together and give these gentlemen the stage and platform that they deserve because of what they've built and what they created for us. And essentially, the Soda Crackers, all we do is just think about what those guys did and we just try to recreate it as best we can.
Yeah. Another thing is that I read it was your idea to start having dances here at the Fairfax Grange.
Yeah. A friend of the Soda Crackers, Heather, her kids would dance here at the Fairfax Grange. And my dad had taken photos here a long time ago and kind of vaguely remembered this place. But I grew up in like Westchester downtown, so I don't come out to the east side too often. After the Pioneer shows were done, I was trying to still kind of find special events to put on and shows to, you know, play around town, and wanted to put on something big and better. My dad and I came down here on a Friday night, and as soon as I walked in that door, I saw this place and I was like, oh my God, this is perfect for the Soda Crackers to put on a show here. And we've put on four, we call them Rancho Roundups here at the Fairfax Grange.
Nice.
We put on four Rancho Roundups here at the Fairfax Grange, and we have a fifth one in the works for the later part of 2025. And then I joined the board of directors here at the Fairfax Grange last February because I wanted to be a part of the improvements and the restoration of the hall and make sure that nothing happens to it, because, you know, we have no honky-tonks left anymore because of various reasons.
Yeah.
The Crystal Palace is for sale. We don't know what's going to happen to the Crystal Palace. And then all but one of our dance halls is still around. The Rainbow Gardens, the Basque Hall is still around, but it's not open to the public. So
yeah,
this is kind of like the last kind of old school dance hall spot we have here in town. So I wanted to be a part of the resurgence of the Fairfax Grange. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
To end the show, we always shout out some current local artists. So do you have any current local bands that you want to shout out on the podcast?
I mean, there's so many talented people here in Bakersfield. And also, you know, on that note, I really think, and I'm very optimistic that the music scene and just the scene in general here in Bakersfield, not just for country music, but for other genres of music here in Bakersfield, I think we're really having a renaissance, and there's a lot of really cool things happening, a lot of cool people doing amazing stuff here in town. And it's still hard, and I think it's always has been hard for musicians to make a living or earn a or get a following and that kind of stuff. But like our buddy Kyle Appleton plays in a bunch of bands, and he records and he repairs everybody's instruments. He's like the glue to our scene here in Bakersfield. So big shout out to Kyle Appleton. Devin Brinsfield records and writes a lot of his own music that I love, and he's doing a great job. Los Hermanos Mendoza are a trio of brothers who are putting out their own music, and, you know, they're doing big and amazing things. They're going on tour now.
Yeah.
You know, Vince Galindo here in town, he's been holding it down for a long time, and he plays great traditional country and western music. And there's, I mean, I know I'm forgetting a few people, but those are the four or five that come to mind. Nice. Joey Boone, my buddy Joey Boone's a great singer, songwriter. Yeah, there's so many people out here. I'm sorry if I forgot you. Yeah, you know, I would just say that, again, you know, I never thought the Soda Crackers would last this long, especially when INDIP started becoming, like, the de facto leader, because I had never been a part of a band, and I never led a band before. I just kind of kept it going. There's a lot of, like, tough times and a lot of, like, really tough moments where I was like, I don't think this is worth it anymore. And I still have a lot of those feelings every now and then where you're just like, you know, this is tough. There's a lot of circumstances and a lot of things you feel like are just falling on top of your head and you can't handle it anymore. But there's that moment where, like, right before the show starts, especially when, like, a place at the Grange, like, I love playing at the Grange because it's so much work and so much effort to get a show at the Grange or anywhere, like, going. So just to get the guys all in one spot with their amps plugged in, wearing the right clothes and having songs ready to go and everything that it takes just to get to the point where you're ready to play music, that like last 4 minutes before a show is like the most fun for me, because I'm like, all the work's done, all of the stuff is behind me, now we get to go up there and do what we love, and I get to play with my best friends, you know.
Yeah,
there's a lot of times, like I said, there's a lot of times where it's really, really sucks, but then there's the moments where you get to play with Norm Hamlet, Merle's steel guitar player, and you just like, there's nothing else in the world that matters, you know? And so being a part of this Grange Hall, being a part of the Bakersfield Sound community and the Bakersfield community as a whole really means a lot to me. And the Soda Crackers will always try for the most traditional, most authentic country and western, Bakersfield Sound, western swing experience and dance for everybody. And we hope that everybody comes out and sees one of our shows.